Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. This summer marks the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Summer, when SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and idealistic young people from around the country descended on Mississippi and Alabama to register black voters and fight for social justice. Among those numbers were photojournalist Matt Herron, my guest today, and four other photographers who documented the lives, the violence against, and the courage of those civil rights workers. The Southern Documentary Project was the idea of Herron, then a young, idealistic photojournalist who had moved his family to Mississippi the previous year to work in civil rights and to freelance for Life and Look magazines and the Saturday Evening Post. With inspiration from his friend and mentor, Dorothea Lang, the Southern Documentary Project chronicled some of the most important events of that summer. Places like Milestone, Hattiesburg, and Ruleville, Mississippi, and Selma, Alabama, where a Southern documentary photographer was nearly beaten to death by a sheriff's posse. The 160 black and white photographs of the book picture services at a Mississippi sharecropper's church, inspirational encounters between young white college students and black families living and working together to build freedom schools and community centers. The anguish of the family of James Chaney, and especially his younger brother Ben after his murder at the hands of the Klan in Neshoba County. And finally, the epic confrontation at the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City, where the Freedom Democratic Party delegates challenged the official Mississippi delegation on the convention floor. Some powerful photographs and meaningful photographs in this book. Mississippi Eyes is the name of the book, the story and photography of the Southern Documentary Project. My guest today is photojournalist Matt Herron. Matt Herron, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Take us back to 1964. You spent the whole summer in Mississippi documenting the Freedom Summer, culminating in the convention's hall at Atlantic City during the National Democratic Convention, when the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party tried to challenge the official Mississippi delegates to the convention. You were there the whole summer. How did this project, this Southern Documentary Project, get started?
Well, actually, I was there a bit longer. I moved to Mississippi with my family in the summer of 1963, right after Medgar Evers was assassinated. My wife and I had been active in peace activity in Philadelphia. I'd been running activities for the Society of Friends, the Quakers. And we decided if we wanted to be really relevant, we had to go south. It was a call that a lot of people answered, but we were the only family with two children to move south and join the civil rights movement. So I came in probably June or July of 1963. I had just started my career as a photojournalist. I'd had a picture in Life and an 8-page story in Look, and I thought I could survive by handling assignments in the South from magazine editors that I already knew in New York. But my real purpose was to help the civil rights movement. And I didn't see myself as a soldier in the trenches so much as an advisor to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. I helped them set up their darkroom in Atlanta. I helped train photographers and did what I could. And when I wasn't doing magazine assignments, which was most of the time, I was shooting for SNCC. I thought of myself as wearing three hats. The first hat, of course, with the press card and the hat band, was a photojournalist. And in addition to that, I thought of myself as a propagandist, in the better sense of the word, for the civil rights movement, taking photographs with a definite purpose of furthering the aims of the movement, most of which were shipped north to be used by Friends of SNCC groups or black newspapers or other people in the cause. But early in my career, I had had a couple of important meetings with Dorothea Lange, who photographed the plight of Dust Bowl people during the 30s and 40s and 50s.
Yeah, she pretty much chronicled the Depression era. I mean, her photographs have become iconic of what the Depression was like, especially for migrant workers in California.
Yeah, exactly. Dorothea convinced me that photography could be more than just a neat profession, that it could be a way of life. and that if it was to become a way of life, I had to really devote myself to it. So I kind of married my social concerns for human rights and black liberation and all that stuff and peace activity with my photography. And it was, I think, a powerful marriage. It gave me the courage to go into situations that I wouldn't have been able to handle otherwise. So in the spring of 1964, the people I knew in the civil rights movement were figuring out how to bring 1,000 college students into the South to work in, to teach in freedom schools and to work in voter registration. So my thought was, what can I do? And I had tried earlier to start a documentary project similar to the FSA, but on a much smaller scale, and failed. And I thought, why not run a team of documentary photographers in the South? So I got in touch with Dorothea. She agreed to be my advisor, and I recruited four guys and myself, and raised some money, and we were active, very active, for the summer of 1964. And my intention was that it should be a longer project, university-sponsored, and so on, but times were tough, and it was hard to raise money, and I'm not a great money raiser anyway, so the project actually had this brief life during the summer. But we made some interesting photographs. We had some interesting war stories, and I decided to put it all into the book.
In fact, this almost didn't get off the ground because you couldn't raise the money, and then you finally turned to a friend, and he was able to raise the money in literally a few days or matter of days.
I walked into the office of Howard Chapnick, who was the director of Black Star Agency in New York, and I was getting on toward summer. I'd been in New York. I was desperate, and I poured out my woes to Howard. He said, well, what do you need? The smallest sum I could think of was $10,000. Seems like a paltry sum today, but it was real money in 1964.
Yeah, that was probably a middle-class year's salary or more.
Well, something like that. At any rate, Howard got on the phone, and he raised the money in 20 minutes. He got half of it from Life in return for a guarantee that we would be there, quote, and if something happened. And a labor union and Black Star put up the rest. And I was absolutely stunned. I walked out of the office sort of in a dream, because now I had the money to go ahead and do what I wanted to do. So it was an interesting moment for me, an interesting lesson in how these things march forward.
And the book starts in Selma. Was this one of the first assignments that your documentary photographers went to cover?
Well, it wasn't quite that formal. One of my photographers, Dave Prince, had a Life assignment to go to Selma. And he took a writer with him, and Selma was kind of, it was almost a rat trap. That's probably not a good way to describe it, but Selma was run by a very aggressive and violent sheriff named Jim Clark, and he owned the town. Whatever he decided pretty much went, and he had a posse of armed thugs, really, whose only qualifications were they had to be white men of voting age. And with the posse, why Clark ruled Selma. And my guys were instructed to go first to Clark, show credentials, and explain that they were in town and so on. And Clark was initially affable. But then the local district attorney came into his office with an article that that the writer had written, which was very, very critical, course of segregation, and that was the end of it. He advised them to get out of town. They didn't get out of town. They attended a mass meeting that night. The sheriff's posse was outside, and when folks filed out of the meeting, they were attacked. And Prince was trying to take photographs, and he was clubbed, and his cameras were smashed. He ran to the back of the church. He tried to climb a fence. There was a shot, and the sapling that he was climbing on was cut off at the top. He came back. A couple of guys beat him with baseball bats. He crawled under the church. They threw a tear gas grenade under the church, And eventually he was dragged to the front of the church, and they were about to kill him when the same district attorney arrived. And I think he probably said something like, well, you know, if you boys do this, it's going to look bad. At any rate, they got out of town. And I arrived the next day, and I was scared to death. And I thought, how am I going to find the action? So I drove across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which was the first leg of the Selma March, and quite well known. And there in front of me, like a movie set, was this line of demonstrators being marched by the police to jail. And so I threw my Volkswagen van into a vacant lot, threw film into my cameras, and ran around to the city hall. There was a small group of embattled-looking journalists there, including a Canadian television crew from the CBC. And I asked, where is everybody? And they said, they're behind the jail. And I knew they were beating people behind the jail, so I tried to get an angle with my long lens so I could photograph that. And a couple of cops charged me. I ran. I felt a billy club crease my back, but I was moving so fast that nothing happened. And then there was a big crash, and I saw the Oricon camera of the CBC television guy bouncing across the pavement. And he grabbed up his camera, scooped up his camera, ran to the opposite corner. And as he did that, I saw this little something skittering along the pavement. And I was in a very addled state at that point. I wasn't thinking clearly. And I scooped it up. There was a snick button. It had clasped black and white hands. And I ran toward him, holding the thing out and yelling at the top of my voice, "You lost your snick button." At any rate, they left town that night, and I stayed. And I expected I might have visitors in my hotel room that evening. I found the black janitor of the hotel, and I said, "Warn me if you can, if a bunch of good old boys are coming to beat me up." And the next evening, I was in the same church with the same posse outside. And it was not a happy situation. My flash was giving out, and I finally sat on the balcony, and there was another reporter there. I explained to him what had happened the night before, and he said, "Well, let's leave early." So we sauntered out of the church over to where the posse was standing and made casual conversation in my best fake New Orleans accent. And when the people filed out of the church, nothing happened. Journalists were present. So we cooled the whole situation while saving our own hides. I guess that's the way to describe it.
There's a picture from that section that really gives you a sense of what Selma was like in that particular time. You did this picture. It was of that meeting where the African-American citizens are sitting there very quietly, and in the back, sort of leaning up against a wall, is a plainclothes policeman who is making no effort to blend in. He's just sitting there watching the proceedings and just, you know, taking it all in and figuring out what's being said and figuring out who's going to get their head busted, I think, later.
Actually, it was a different mass meeting in Selma, but kind of the same situation. And the cop, well, I think I said that they owned the town. You can, looking at his stance, that's the stance of a man who owns the situation. And he can just barge in on any black activity and monitor it without any permission whatsoever. I thought it was pretty indicative of the psychological state of that town, so I kind of liked the photograph.
No. Now, in this same section, you sort of detail your rules for covering these civil rights demonstrations. You had several rules that probably held you in good stead and probably kept you alive during the course of it. What are those rules?
Well, they were my rules for survival. They really boiled down to four. Number one, never be a hero. The job of the photographer is to witness what's going on And then to get to the airport and somehow get that film on a plane, either to New York or Atlanta, and anything less is failure. So getting arrested, getting beaten, getting your camera smashed doesn't make you a hero. It makes you a first-class chump. And we did anything necessary to get the pictures and get out of there.
You also said it was important to keep moving in a demonstration because if you stand in one place, then you become a focus of, you know, if the opposition is there, they can focus in on you. If you're always moving, you're a moving target.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if there are a bunch of good old boys who decide they want to beat up on you, it usually takes them a few minutes to get organized. And by then, I'm somewhere else. But the other thing I learned as a photojournalist was keeping moving always results in better pictures. You're always constantly looking for the right angle. If something is happening half a block away, that's where you want to be. So it served two purposes. And the other, one of the other things was always profess to be absolutely clear that you have a right to be there and you're doing your job, and people will usually assume that somebody's giving you permission. There was a situation one morning. Danny Lyon, one of the photographers who worked with me, came into a forest clearing where a church had been burned the night before. There were something like 35 black churches burned during that summer, probably by the Klan. So he's pulling his cameras out. The smoking ruins are there. And as he's getting ready to work, into the glade comes a sheriff's car with the flashers going. It's potentially a very dangerous situation. You have an armed sheriff, an unarmed photographer who is obviously the enemy, and no witnesses around. So Danny goes directly to the sheriff's car, shows him his credentials, says, "Hello, I'm Danny Lyon. The FBI will be here in 5 minutes. The sheriff, whereupon, pulls out his credentials to demonstrate his right to be in that situation. Danny takes his pictures and drives off. But we did that more than once. The final rule I had was, if all else fails, take refuge in a black neighborhood. And black neighborhoods in the South were coherent communities where people supported each other and knew each other intimately. And most residents of black communities kept a shotgun or a rifle packed behind the front door. And I had, on more than one occasion, the experience that if I met anyone coming in and I was in danger and I came into a black community, they would understand almost immediately from my respectful attitude and my tone of voice that I wasn't a Southern segregationist. And if I asked for help, they'd usually help me. Mm. People, you know, sometimes agreed to do things that put them in great danger to get me out of trouble. I mean, I was going to leave, but they had to stay there and face the consequences.
My guest today is photojournalist Matt Herron. His new book is titled Mississippi Eyes, The Stories and Photography of the Southern Documentary Project, which documents his work and work of the other photographers in the Southern Documentary Project in the summer of 1964 throughout the South, Mississippi, Alabama. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. One of the most interesting things about this book is you document the activities of SNCC, as well as the Freedom Schools. And you were talking about the shotgun behind the door. There's this incredibly haunting photo of two gentlemen on, they built a community center, or a Freedom School perhaps, and they're looking out a window with a shotgun. They're on shotgun watch because they really expected the building to be firebombed at any time.
Yeah. It was a community center. It was built by Abe Osheroff, who was a veteran of the Spanish Civil War, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. And he raised, I think, $10,000 in Venice, California, and came to a small black farming community in the Delta, Milestone, and built this community center. The guys are sitting in a library, and it's stacked with books that have been donated by Friends of SNCC groups in the North. And as you said, they're on shotgun watch. You know, the Klan would come down these backcountry dirt roads at night and try to shoot up or firebomb a building. And, of course, a brand-new community center was a prime target. But it wasn't so easy. And, in fact, if any of us were driving down that road at night, the porch lights were usually on in all the houses, and it made sense to tap your horn a couple times before you passed by, because you were pretty sure there was somebody there watching and protecting the neighborhood. Hmm. It's kind of the untold story of the civil rights movement that in spite of the profession of nonviolence, local people defended their homes, and they did it with firearms.
Yeah.
And the Klan knew this as well as anyone else. So it's kind of a standoff there quite often.
I think some of the best parts of the book are documenting this work that was going on, where you had volunteers coming to the South, you had the community rising up itself to educate itself, to learn about the process of voting, to make sure that, you know, the work registering, but also a lot of just the downtime, you know, where there would be a dance in that community hall, or kids washing out back behind the pump, just really documenting what was going on during that summer of 1964, the non-tense times as well as the tense times.
I think that's probably the prize of the book. I mean, we were there not just to record the actions, but try and catch the manner of life. What it was like, particularly black life in the South. My favorite pictures are a series I took of a small country church service.
Yes.
In Valley View, Mississippi. This was a church of sharecroppers. If you look at the photographs, they are immaculately dressed because Sunday was the big day of the week. Sunday was the day when people who were referred to as John and Mary by their white overseers became Mrs. Smith and Mr. Jones to each other. They addressed each other formally. They wore their best clothes. It was a moment when they gave and received respect and really affirmed their own humanity. So it was more than just a religious, I guess a you would say it was a religious social experience for these folks. My favorite picture is a shot of a group of young boys after church service, and they're all standing in a grove of trees behind the church, and I just said to them, hey, why don't you stand there and I'll take your picture?
Mm-hmm.
They lined up almost in a social grouping. You can see the boys who are not quite sure they belong there standing on the outside, and the older guys don't quite trust me, and they're in the back. But in front are a group of boys in their very best clothes, and they're standing stiff and straight so that I can see how well-dressed they are. And there's a kind of a pride and integrity in that group of boys that still moves me today. But years later, I came back and visited the church and spoke to the pastor. He said, you know, the folks used to walk the dusty roads to church in the morning carrying their shoes, walking barefoot and carrying their shoes because they wanted them to be spotless when they put them on for service.
Hmm.
So those kinds of scenes really, they kind of entered our hearts. I mean, Mississippi was a scary place. I was scared for years afterward by the thought of Mississippi, but I also loved it. And it kind of got under the skin, not only of me, but I think of all the volunteers who came south that summer. Nobody was the same after that summer. People went back and changed their lives. They joined caring professions. They became doctors and lawyers working in civil rights. It was a life-changing experience for me, and I think for everybody who was there.
It was interesting. One of the young men you take a picture of, who are one of the volunteers that come down, he ends up being the leader of the free speech movement at Berkeley the next fall. He comes down there. He's so energized by what happened. I want to leave folks with another a couple of pictures that you have. It's of, I guess he was the town plumber, Oliver Patrick, in Chula, I believe it's Mississippi. You have a portrait of him, just a beautiful portrait of him, and then a picture of his sort of ramshackle house, which fills with a Wurlitzer jukebox in front of the house. And it, basically, he put them out there. It says, folks pass by me. They see this mess. It says, he ain't up to nothing.
Patrick was a survivor. I mean, there were really two modes for black people getting along in Mississippi. One was to keep your head down and get along as best you could. And the other was to be a leader and get shot at and try to change things. Patrick was one of the former. He was the only man in Chula who knew where the pipes went and what flowed through them. But as a black man, he had no status whatsoever. He had inside his house a couple of, I can't call them freezers, they were huge freezer chests, and they were stacked to the brim with packages of okra, hog meat, anything you can imagine. That man could have survived for 2 years if the electricity didn't fail on what was in his freezers. And he had figured out how to stay alive and maintain his integrity and not allow anyone to step on him, but not get in the way where he could be stepped on. He was quite a remarkable guy. And an interesting contrast to, you know, the civil rights figures who were out there in front, like Fannie Lou Hamer, taking all kinds of crap from the local folks.
Yeah. What is a really strong book that documents this summer, 50 years ago now, the Freedom Summer of 1964? Matt Herron, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, it's been a great pleasure, and I must say you have you developed a really strong sense of the book. I appreciate that.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Photojournalist Matt Herron speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He headed up the Southern Documentary Project during the summer of 1964 throughout the South. His new book, featuring 160 black and white photographs of that summer, is titled Mississippi Eyes, The Story and Photography of the Southern Documentary Project. It's published by the University Press of Mississippi. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.